This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network podcast on critical theory. My name is Lucas Hoffman, and I'm one of the hosts of the podcast series. I'm also a graduate student in the Carolina Duke Graduate Program in German Studies and a visiting scholar at the Humboldt University in Berlin. Joining me today is Sebastian Truskalowski, an assistant professor in German Cultural Studies at the University of Manchester. His PhD was awarded in 2016 by Goldsmiths University of London, where he was affiliated with the Department of Visual Cultures and the Center for Philosophy and Critical Thought. Before going to Manchester, Sebastian taught German and comparative literature at Trinity College Dublin and King's College London, and was awarded a fellowship from the Alexander von Humboldt Foundation for his research at the Leibniz Zentrum für Literatur und Kulturforschung in Berlin. Today, we'll be talking about his book titled Adorno and the Ban on Images. Sebastian, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Lucas. Thank you very much for having me. I'm very pleased to be here and looking forward to discussing the book.
Yeah. I'm very much looking forward to discussing this with you. I really enjoyed reading your book. So let's go ahead and start with the classic new books question. What brought you to write this book?
Yeah, well, the book was born out of a PhD project. This is, in fact, a reworked version of my thesis, which, as you noted, I completed in 2016 at the University of London's Goldsmiths College. I began working there initially with Alex Duttmann, who had then, after some time, moved to Berlin. And I continued the project and then wound up finishing it with Alberto Toscano. And some input from other colleagues who were on hand. I applied with a project on Adorno, having been struck in my reading by a kind of conspicuous recurrence of this these references to the Old Testament ban on image making or idol worship, if you like. And it seemed to me to be an unusual kind of, you know, figure or motif or image, you know, no pun intended, for Adorno to reach for, you know, given his sort of explicitly Marxist and materialist orientation. And so I began to wonder about, you know, how it is that he made this, or that he hoped to make this notionally theological figure work for him. And since it seemed to recur at kind of critical junctures in his thinking on epistemology, on aesthetics, but also in his kind of fraught relationship with metaphysics, it seemed to me that it might be, you know, at the very least, an interesting exercise to try and make sense of how that works or doesn't for him. And as I began to pull that thread, you know, I found that, you know, it began to resonate with other and more contemporary kind of philosophical issues that were on my mind, questions around materialism, around Marxism, around a thinking of kind of utopia in the present. And so what started out as a kind of, you know, point of, you know, textual or philological curiosity wound up, for me at least, as a bigger sort of philosophical set of questions and wound up starting from this very modest sort of standpoint in order to engage with Adorno's work and some of its contemporary resonance more broadly.
Yeah. I think that comes through so clearly in your book. You do make the decision not just to sort of look at the sort of the back history of Adornian thought and looking at Marx and Kant and Hegel, but you also choose to include contemporary theorists like Mesayu, Agamben, Lyotard, and others. Could you maybe talk a little bit about your decision to include post-Adornian thinkers in this book as well?
Yeah, I think the reason I decided to do that was partly to illustrate my sense that Adorno was engaging with issues that continue to interest, you know, philosophers also in the present, and you know, also people from very different kind of camps and intellectual trajectories, if you like, people like Meyasu, like Agamben, like Lyotard. But the reason I decided to include them in the book, apart from illustrating the kind of contemporary relevance of Adorno, was that I thought it spoke in a way to an aspect of Adorno's method, if you can call it that, which is that he tends to play off existing positions against each other by way of forging his own kind of standpoint, if you can call it that. And I thought that maybe inhabiting this way of working would actually work well for the book. So yeah, kind of a two-part answer. On the one hand, to illustrate the contemporary resonance, I hope contemporary resonance of what Adorno was doing, and in part to work in a way that I hope is sensitive to the way that Adorno himself chose to work in engaging with questions of materialism, for example, in the case of Meyasu, but also aesthetic questions in the engagement with Lyotard.
Yeah, I think you the book does quite a wonderful job of arguing for the contemporary relevance of Adorno. And in many ways, I think a lot of thinkers have sort of moved past Adorno without really engaging, especially the arguments from Adorno and this idea of the image ban and Adorno's sort of motivations and arguments for a sort of ban on utopian thought. And they've sort of moved past it without engaging with it directly. And so I think like bringing back in those contemporary theorists really does draw in the contemporary relevance of Adorno's thought. So moving further, the first chapter of your book, like in many ways, right, can be understood as a close explication of Adorno's epistemology, right, as a sort of epistemological focus, by a rather interesting means of a critique of Lenin. So you look at Adorno's critique of Lenin and in order to explicate his epistemology. So can you maybe give our listeners a sense of the stakes of Adorno's imageless materialism, right?
Yeah, that's right. So the formulation of an imageless materialism is the title of a subsection of negative dialectics in the first part, what Adorno sometimes refers to as the kind of, you know, epistemological or epistemocritical sort of part of the book. The reason that I engage in this chapter with Adorno's reading of Lenin really kind of forced itself on me, if you like, because of the fact that Adorno himself explicitly engages with Lenin there. However, he does so in a way that is ultimately, I think, kind of polemical, shall we say, right? This is not reading of Lenin with Lenin and on Lenin's terms, so to say. It's an occasion for Adorno to intervene kind of polemically in a conversation about, you know, the philosophical stakes of Marxism more generally. And he chose to set up, you know, I mean, on some reading, one might say a kind of a straw man in the form of Lenin, whose materialism or, you know, kind of concept of materialism he sketches in order to then take it down. And in doing so, kind of, you know, lay bare his own sort of take on the issue of philosophical materialism and the way that it relates to a thinking of politics and so on in Marx. The other reason I wound up with this, engaging with this question of an imageless materialism is because The way Adorno sets up the case, the way Adorno sets up this polemic with Lenin, is that he claims that Lenin's account of a primacy of matter, which is supposed to, in the end, in Lenin's own big book on materialism and imperial criticism from 1908, this kind of, you know, meta-scientific opus, the way he sets that up is that Lenin's epistemology, his account of the primacy of matter and the way that that's supposed to safeguard a primacy of kind of praxis through a series of kind of slightly singular maneuvers, relies on a theory of reflection, as he calls it, which he, that is Adorno, traces back all the way to kind of pre-Socratic philosophies, with the idea being that, you know, the world exists, you know, as it is, and is then somehow mirrored, if you like, as sense data by you know, human sort of sensory apparatus. In Lenin's book is a kind of peculiar one because it's really it plays out a series of sort of factional debates within the sort of Soviet project, you know, circa 1908, via an engagement with other epistemologies and especially philosophies engaging with questions of physics. A lot turns on this this idea of, you know, sensory apparatus mirroring a world that is above all, you know, material and real, and somehow has primacy over these, you know, subjective whims that Lenin identifies in other a range of other Russian and Soviet thinkers. And Adorno takes up this observation, you know, without engaging actually with the issue in any great depth, as a polemical occasion to sort of say that, well, all this amounts to, right, this kind of, you know, professing to a you know, an investment in the primacy of matter is a kind of dogmatic and naive sort of realism, right, which turns on an epistemology that on its own, you know, kind of self-understanding, it relies very heavily on a notion of images, of the image, so to speak. And what Adorno suggests more than spells out, right, is that this approach to materialism that Lenin sketches via this peculiar, you know, kind of discussion of physics and philosophy in the Russian or Soviet context circa 1908, right, that this, in fact, sits very oddly alongside the political stakes of what Lenin is professing to do. So he claims, right, that it's difficult to see how the kind of you know, theory of mind, if you want to call it that Lenin is laying out there, how that is supposed to be conducive to the kind of revolutionary and spontaneous and so on, you know, praxis that is supposed to be at the heart of Marxism or you know, any kind of communism, really. And identifying this particular aspect, you know, whether he does so fairly or not, right, identifying this particular dimension of Lenin's thought then sets up a kind of a semantic field in which Adorno can take up this notion of a thinking in kind of images, right, as the world as being primarily material and then being mirrored in thought in these kind of, you know, reflections in a manner that is supposed to recall even aspects of certain, you know, like pre-Socratic kind of materialisms, atomism and so on. It opens up a semantic field where the polemic that Adorno sets up can turn rhetorically on a figure of an image ban, right? Because if you're not thinking in images that mirror reality in the way that Lenin supposedly outlines, yeah, then what are you doing? Well, presumably you're thinking in something that is not images, right? And again, because the way Adorno presents this is as a materialism that is the dogmatic root of a kind of, he calls it, I think, something like a religion of state, right? So he introduces not just a set of terms related to a thinking in images, which on a certain reading, of course, and via Benjamin and so on, he does himself, but he introduces also a set of terms to do with questions of religion. And then suddenly, you know, you're in quite an interesting arena in which Adorno can, on the terms that he has himself and maybe a bit conveniently set up for himself, you can introduce the figure of the image ban as a polemical sort of, you know, like stab at a notion of materialism that is supposed to lie at the root of socialism as practiced in the Soviet Union and, you know, its wider sphere of influence, which, bearing in mind that Adorno was writing this in the 1960s from his position in West Germany as a Marxist of sorts, but one unsympathetic to the way the project had panned out in the so-called Eastern Bloc, it kind of, you know, it occasions a rethinking of the philosophical stakes of Marxism, especially via the question of materialism in its relation to something like praxis, in its relation to something like politics. And that, I thought, was a curious thread to kind of follow up, even though I have to say my own interest in Lenin per se, a bit like Adorno's, is ultimately limited. And even though the particular kind of conflicts that Lenin was engaged in his own time and in his own context are really, I would say, in a sense, a matter of kind of specialist interest today because they're so far gone, right? Not only the physics that informed them is you know, now over 100 years later, kind of, you know, no longer state of the art, but also the sort of philosophical issues seem to have been overcome in a sense, although then curiously, of course, they are echoed in you know, for reasons of his own, I suppose, in that famous essay by Quentin Meyersault on the après la finitude, after finitude.
Yeah. I was just going to follow up and ask, could you maybe say a few words about your Adornian critique of Meyersault? All right. So you bring in at the end of this chapter on imageless materialism, you bring in Meyersault's after finitude, and you show that the epistemic concerns that Adorno is dealing with in his critique of Lenin are not outdated. Maybe you could explain your sort of Adornian take on Meyersault a little bit further.
Yeah. When I first arrived at Goldsmiths, just for context, Meyersault was like really all the rage. That was still something people really were talking about. That essay was widely discussed in my early kind of grad school days. I think the interest in that text in particular has maybe subsided a little bit since then. Also since more of Meyersault's project has kind of come into focus and the particular status of that essay came to be debated along other lines than maybe it was originally. But Meyersault, a figure that's often discussed in the context of what came to be known for better or worse as speculative realism. Meyersault often discussed alongside authors associated with other new materialisms, including people like Graham Harman and so on. I mean, for all the differences between them. It's a curious and interesting book, which makes the provocative and, I think, on its own terms, persuasive claim that, you know, we may indeed, and after all, have access to something like mind-independent matter, which is, in fact, you know, through our thinking, through our kind of, you know, philosophical lenses, which is, you know, in a sense, a claim that the book shares with Lenin's big book on materialism. That and certain other parallels are something that hadn't eluded some commentators. So I remember, I think it's Žižek in his big book on Hegel, picks up on this and kind of, you know, makes the claim that Meyersault's after finitude is a reworking in a way of Lenin's theory of materialism or concept of materialism for the 21st century. I don't know if I'd go so far. I mean, the stated or explicit philosophical or political stakes of Meyersault's book are, you know, he keeps those much you know, closer to his chest than Lenin does. It's not that this is in any obvious way a book about Lenin. It just so happens that some of its claims seem to mirror claims made previously by Lenin in their more pointedly sort of philosophical register, which is obviously not something that people tend in the first instance to associate with Lenin, who's for good reason a figure thought of more in political terms, and you know, remembered for his kind of organizing and so on, maybe then for his philosophical reflections as such. But be that as it may, the provocative claim, as I said, was that, you know, one can have, you know, despite what Kant and others might have us believe, one can have, according to Meyersu, access to sort of, you know, mind-independent matter, the great out there, so to speak, you know, absolute primacy of a kind of material world. I try to then apply a kind of an Adornian lens to this argument, which, as I say, in some respects mirrors Lenin's, to show that, you know, there's a danger of a kind of fetish of immediacy, I think, in such thinking, and that also in the way, specific way that Meyersu frames this question of being, this question of the necessity of contingency, as he puts it, the possibility of absolute, spontaneous, radical, ex nihilo transformation. But this poses kind of what it poses, in a sense, kind of, you know, political problems, because it's hard to see in the way that Meyersu, but in, you know, related terms also Lenin, how they ascribe any kind of agency to any sort of, you know, active political subject, right, in this process of transformation that in this case Meyersu is describing. So I hope that by bringing Adorno's polemic against Lenin to bear on this particular text, the stakes of, you know, why we might want to talk about matter or materialism or the supposed primacy of matter in the context of a philosophical discussion that is in one way or another sort of Marx adjacent at the very least, why that should matter. And it seems to me that actually Adorno's point about, you know, dogmatically asserting, you know, the great out there, as it were, that this is not helpful for a thinking about a transformative kind of politics, partly because for Adorno, the important thing about materialism is really to do with an alleviation of kind of bodily suffering, and not with asserting, you know, the existence of a great beyond that you can in one form or another kind of access intellectually. So I wanted to bring it back via Adorno to a conversation not about the potential for ex nihilo transformation because, you know, our whatever, you know, intellectual apparatus prohibits us from seeing the fundamental instability of things out there, and bring it back to a conversation about, you know, what, at least according to Adorno, and I have to say on this point I'm inclined to agree, what matters about matter, yeah, not to labor the pun, right? What matters about matter, questions of bodily suffering, of need and privation, and of the alleviation of bodily suffering, which is ultimately what a kind of materialist utopia, on Adorno's terms, would have to be oriented towards. One thing I should add with regards to all of this is that the reason I begin with a chapter on epistemology is that, you know, in a very basic sense, I think the question of the image ban in Adorno is about how to figure, how to portray, how to represent, how to think, how to intellectually kind of, you know, fix an image of a world beyond suffering and privation, beyond, you know, in injustice and all the rest. And the epistemic or epistemological challenge, I suppose, is, well, how do you portray, figure, represent a world that is categorically different to the one that we have, if the only tools that you have at your disposal for representing such a world are the ones that, by definition, as it were, already exist, right? So how do you think your way out of that corner, so to speak? And it seems to me that Adorno's appeal to materialism is supposed to introduce into this kind of, you know, intellectual puzzle, a kind of somatic dimension. And the insistence on the mere existence on the great, on a great beyond or a great out there, as it were, right? You know, asserting the absolute primacy of mind-independent matter to Adorno, and I have to say, like I say, I'm inclined to agree with him on this. It's not clear to me what that does conversation about, you know, transformative kind of social practices or politics for that matter.
I think that makes quite a bit of sense and really sort of lays out the stakes that are oftentimes so obscured in the discourse on Adorno and this very sort of dense thinker. I was wondering, maybe we can move a bit to talk about this idea of inverse theology that you spend a lot of time. This is actually how I came to your work initially. I was looking and navigating the sort of various literatures on the theological discourse connected to Adorno, which is sort of very disorienting when you first get there. And I really enjoyed that chapter in this book because I think you are one of the clearest voices that speaks to the particularities of how Adorno picks up on theological thought in a structural fashion, right? In order to articulate his own theory. He's not doing theology or speculating on the Godhead, but there are these theological images that recur that are sort of like contribute formally to the way that Adorno is thinking. So my question is maybe more for our listeners who might not be familiar with the theological discourse surrounding Adorno. Why is theology a relevant concept when talking about Adorno at all, right? When we're talking about this materialist Marxist thinker, why are we using theological metaphors to begin with?
Yeah, quite right. First of all, I'm glad you enjoyed the chapter and the article that it's based on. That's great to hear. Thank you. There is, as you say, a slim but, you know, kind of growing body of writings that has picked up on, you know, if nothing else, the recurrence of kind of theological figures, motifs, terms, and so on in Adorno's thinking. As I said at the beginning, it's striking that this should be the case because it's not obvious how that works. You know, Adorno is quite explicit at various points throughout his work that, you know, traditional theology is kind of historically outmoded. Positive religion is not restorable. These are facets of, you know, what he elsewhere might describe as a kind of dialectic of enlightenment. Religion and theology and the kind of, you know, mosaic religions, Judaism, Christianity in particular, contain elements of truth, kernels of truth, salvageable and redeemable moments, but overall they are what they are, which is to say kind of outmoded moments in the unfolding of a grand kind of historical narrative that Adorno adopts and adapts from Hegel to some measure. Having said that, one of the things that I believe justifies his recourse to terms like the image band, to, you know, also figures like the messianic light to which he sometimes refers, is a peculiar kind of constellation, historical constellation that emerges and that I think can be, you know, placed arguably under the banner of what you know, Adorno's friend Walter Benjamin calls a kind of capitalist cult religion, right? Modernity in its unfolding in a story, you know, loosely akin to the one told often by the likes of Max Weber, whose work, of course, Adorno knew well. Modernity and the unfolding of capitalism kind of, you know, usurps the traditional place of religion in the present on this version of events to the point that capitalism in a way starts to function in the present almost like a religion with its terrible sort of feast days, as Benjamin describes them. And it means that in a sort of improbable move, if you follow Adorno via Benjamin or via Weber, if you prefer, it means that the outmoded terms of theology lend themselves in an improbable kind of twist of events to the criticism of present, you know, dominated by a kind of capitalistic cult religion, if you like. Right. So that's one reason that I think, you know, if we follow Adorno on his own terms, justifies his recourse to such figures. And the other is that, you know, what survives in aspects of the kind of Jewish and Christian theology with which Adorno engages is a yearning for transcendence, for reconciliation, for redemption of a certain kind, which, again, you know, if nothing else, I think is at the very least a kind of rhetorical or semantic strategy with which to intimate something beyond, you know, what Adorno describes, I think, evocatively as like a spellbound sphere of existence, of, you know, a world that has been thoroughly kind of disenchanted, as it were. So there's the particular constellation of events which puts theology or religion into a particular kind of, you know, alignment with the capitalist present on the one hand, and on the other hand, there is the yearning for something like, you know, kind of redemption, utopia, the overcoming of worldly injustice, and so on the other. And all those, or rather these two factors, I think, play a particular role. There is a third kind of dimension to this, which is a little more textual, if you like, and it is to do with Adorno's, you know, longstanding friendship and close engagement with the work of Walter Benjamin, also through his friend and erstwhile kind of mentor, Paul Tillich, the Protestant theologian, through his engagement with Kierkegaard and a variety of other thinkers, you know, who operate with terms that are at least borrowed from religion or theology, even if they are not always, you know, in any positive sense, religious or theological. So it winds up being a peculiar set of terms that lend themselves, for the reasons I hope I just, you know, was able to at least point to, that lend themselves to Adorno's effort to lay out the wider stakes of his kind of project.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Yeah, thanks so much. I mean, I think that really helps to sort of clarify this other side of Adorno, which is oftentimes sort of not focused on, and in the focus on negativity, if the way in which these theological images operate in negativity point towards maybe some sort of perhaps a little bit more hopeful sides of Adorno. Mm-hmm. And in your reprise, right, the last section of your book, you include a reflection on the politics that follow from Adorno's negative philosophy, from this idea of negativity, of imagelessness. And you write, quote, Adorno's negative dialectic is both less and more political than his critics suggest, end quote. Can you maybe say a few words on how you understand Adorno's politics, how that sort of relates to this discourse of theology, and then how you think his critics get him wrong?
Yeah, right. Okay, both less and more political than his critics suggest, Adorno's politics. Adorno doesn't have a positive conception of politics that he lays out in any of his major works. Adorno doesn't have a positive conception of a lot of things. Adorno carves out positions that you might then kind of, from which you might then infer certain things, as it were, right? But by playing off kind of existing positions, right? It's often a case of, you know, playing off Kant against Hegel or Hegel against Kant, and, you know, kind of course correcting this, that, or the other with a reference to Romanticism, or with a reference to Weber or Kierkegaard or Marx or Benjamin or any of the other kind of players in his project, or figures that inform his project. I think that can be said of various sort of like nascent dimensions of his thinking, including, for example, his ethics, but also, and significantly, I would say, his politics. Adorno, as a person, you know, as a citizen, if you like, was, of course, a politically engaged person, up to date on current events and engaged in various struggles, you know, famously and contentiously with the German student movement. But if you read the lectures, there are frequent references to apartheid in South Africa to the war in Vietnam. Adorno was a political person in the conventional sense. In what sense is Adorno less political than that might appear? Well, he's often criticized by, you know, from a range of different camps for being a kind of, you know, resigned aesthete who has cornered himself and in an impossible and total kind of negativity that doesn't allow for any hope or socially transformative praxis to take place, because it's all always already implicated in the workings of, you know, the kinds of coercive operations of reason, which in a way he's trying to overturn, right? That's the classic kind of criticism. It's something that you get versions of in Habermas. It's something that you get versions of in, to the left of that, in the camp of Adorno's former students, including figures like Hans-Jürgen Krahl. And you get a different version, but nonetheless related, I would argue, in the work of people like Agamben and Jakob Taubes, who insist that, you know, Adorno's negativity means that all he can ever do is kind of intimate a sort of, you know, as if regulative image of what ought to be, but that can never be reached because of, you know, reasons that are ultimately similar to what Habermas says, which is that if everything is implicated, well, how can you hope to lay out positively an image of the redeemed world to which you are ostensibly, that you're ostensibly working towards. Why do I think that that's not a fair, in all instances, a fair account of Adorno? Well, it seems to me that if you take seriously the scope and scale of the transformation in thinking and by extension acting and kind of, you know, inhabiting, right, the world that Adorno demands, then in fact, you know, politics itself would have to undergo a certain kind of transformation. It starts fairly modestly in Adorno's kind of epistemology of thinking about relationships between, you know, what he calls subject and object. But these poles or coordinates in Adorno's project, I think, are supposed to have real material correlates in the relationship between, say, humankind and nature, as it were, right? Or, let's stick with that one. And to think a rapprochement or a kind of reconciliation between these, just for the sake of explication, I'm going to call them, you know, sort of epistemological terms, yeah. You would have to reconfigure the very manner of thinking in a way that is so far-reaching, right, that the prospective reconciliation between these poles, right, is really what politics would have to mean. The narrow sphere of kind of governance and administration is, of course, those are things with which one must engage because this is the world that we, as it were, live in. But, you know, to really think a kind of Adornian politics in the emphatic sense, I think would require one to follow through on what it is that he demands in, you know, various points in his work, including some of the ones I touch on in the book. Derrida once remarked of Adorno that, you know, it's an effort to, that the whole project can be summarized as an effort to think thinking differently, right? And I think it's only if you can do that, if you can kind of get to grips with this sort of, you know, puzzle, philosophical riddle or problem of what it might mean to picture a world beyond suffering and injustice from the inside out, in acknowledgement of the fact that you are doing so in terms that are always already complicit in the problem that you're trying to overcome. Once you are squarely in that arena, then a thinking of reconciliation between these kind of, you know, poles that had once in the history of philosophy become torn asunder, right, is really, properly speaking, the arena of kind of politics, I think, for Adorno. And in this respect, I would say he is more political than his critics let on, because the implications are so far-reaching. It's only if you think thinking differently, right, that you can imagine a different kind of relationship between, let's say, subject and object or humankind and nature. And it is only when you can attain the state of what Adorno, I think, very suggestively and evocatively calls peace, for example, in his writings on Hölderlin, right? That something like a different conception of kind of universality, a different set of relations in which we and with which we inhabit a world, right? And that seems to me to be rather more emphatic than the kind of, you know, local stakes, however legitimate, okay, of, for example, you know, the German student movement, important as those were to Adorno and important as they may be to us today. So yeah, less political in the sense that, you know, Kral, for example, was surely right to point out that Adorno had abandoned the field of, you know, kind of struggle, you know, as part of the student protests. But I would say that there's ultimately something more political in what he was proposing, because, you know, to really think transformation in the terms that he does is something very, very far-reaching indeed. And it would... There's something kind of uncompromising about it. What he calls a utopia of cognition, you know, these notions of a differentiation without domination, and what that would mean and how that would look is ultimately what Adorno's project, I think, aims at, except that it is faced with its own kind of abidance by this figure of the image ban, which means that those are only ever, I hesitate to call them, like, you know, outcomes that you can kind of cast into relief. You can intimate them negatively, but they're elusive, right? If you start to sketch them out in existent or in extant terms, right, then you're running the danger of reproducing the conditions that you're trying to overcome, right? It's a tricky position for Adorno to be in, yeah. But I do think that it has a very emphatically utopian prospective kind of horizon. And I think to acknowledge that rather than shirk back from it, as many of his critics, I think, do, seems to me to be ultimately quite a hopeful position rather than a, you know, hopeless one.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's such a wonderful way of... summarizing Adorno's thought in a way that overcomes this trendy way of presenting Adorno's politics as some sort of regressive or, you know, abstract ivy tower sort of mode of thinking, and ties in the real materialistic concerns that are always sort of carried through with Adorno, but also sort of acknowledging the sort of divorce of the way that Adorno thinks transformation from a like thinkable praxis or like a translatable praxis. I think that that's really helpful. So maybe now, and I think this actually might help to elucidate some of the politics that you were just talking about. We've talked about sort of the theological, the epistemological roots or structures in Adorno's thought. I thought it might also make sense to talk about sort of the other half of the concerns that the title of your book confesses, namely the aesthetic, right? As Adorno himself says, the Old Testament ban on images has an aesthetic as well as a theological dimension, right? So you're very much... half of the book is dealing with it, with the aesthetics of Adorno's aesthetic theory, in a wonderful way that really elucidated things for me. You write, for Adorno, neither aesthetics nor theory turn out to be adequate for an understanding of art. What he proposes instead is a reflection on the inadequacies of these approaches, particularly where they are thought together. In short, for Adorno, the significance of art it lies precisely in the fact that it eludes theorization while at the same time demanding it, end quote. Could you maybe say a bit more about the epistemic contraction involved in the image ban and how that helps us to better understand art?
Yeah, art in Adorno. You know, Adorno places a great burden on the sorts of operations, intellectual or otherwise, that he associates with, you know, what he calls autonomous works of art, which in this passage that you just quoted back and that I quote in the book, he associates with the theological ban on images. I mean, again, there's a few different ways to approach this. I mean, just by way of kind of like mapping out the terrain, in the first instance, I think this is to do with the fact that Adorno picks up on the frequent, surprisingly frequent recurrence of this motif of the Old Testament ban on images in the history of modern German thought, in Kant, in Hegel in particular. And these are two figures that I closely engage with through Adorno in that chapter on aesthetics. So Kant and Hegel in their respective writings on art and aesthetics. So that's one important thing to note. Adorno is taking us on a detour, a kind of a renewed engagement with the history of German thought. A quick aside on that, I think that it's probably also worth noting that the reason that Adorno keeps kind of, taking us back to conversations of the kind that are being had by Kant and Hegel, where these references to the image ban in their talkings about art and so on occur, the reason he does that is because he is, I think, skeptical of the notion that Marxism, and this is, in the end, a tradition that I would say he considers himself a part of, that Marxism has in fact adequately dealt with philosophy and sort of left it behind. So, revisiting figures like that in these terms is important because the criticism of philosophy, which is ultimately supposed to yield its kind of practical overcoming, right, is as yet incomplete. So, he continues to engage with such questions for those reasons. Now, I think Adorno is, in a sense, also skeptical of the idea that philosophy on its own terms can produce its own overcoming, right? And so he displaces some of that work that would have to occur, right, into different registers and different arenas. And the most prominent of these, I suppose, is art, kind of broadly conceived. I mean, to anyone who's read much Adorno, you'll be aware that at least half of the collected writings are writings on music, right? So there's really a good deal of engagement with music, with literature, less so with the visual arts, but certainly with problems of philosophical aesthetics. One of the specific aesthetic issues with which Adorno engages via his reading of Kant and via his reading of Hegel, partly because this figure of the image ban occurs so prominently in their aesthetic writings, or at least at prominent kind of junctures, is this question of the beauty of nature. Right? What Adorno wants is for the way that the experience of beauty and of the beauty in nature in particular, the way that that is theorized, the way that that plays out, he wants that to, in works of art, paradoxically, he wants that to be the arena in which a reconfigured relationship between humankind and nature, subject and object that I was saying before, to kind of, tacitly emerge, right? He needs the aesthetic because it is also an arena of the kind of somatic. It is partly also to do not just with the structures of judgment, but also with a kind of bodily experience that preempts, I think, something else, as it were. Artworks speak, according to Adorno, and what they say, if you engage with them carefully, is everything to do with the kind of, rifts and dislocations of the present. Ironically, for Adorno, nature, right, which is also kind of noumenal, not something that you can in any immediate sense kind of put your finger on, it's something that appears kind of obliquely in its most thoroughly mediated kind of representations in art. It's through it's a complicated set of kind of coordinates with which Adorno is operating, because he borrows a set of kind of assumptions from other figures along the way, which aren't just Kant and Hegel, an important one is Lukács. He borrows this idea of a second nature, which basically says that, you know, an immediate approach to something like a first nature, you know, a real nature out there is not possible, right? That we live in a world that is so thoroughly conventional, right? That even our relationship to what we call nature is in a sense, you know, always already heavily mediated by all of these factors. But the consequence of that is that the relationship to art as it plays out, sorry, the relationship to nature as it plays out in art becomes an occasion to kind of obliquely relate to this point with which you might like to prospectively reconcile, right, as a subject, namely nature. And it is through an experience of works of art that require you to undergo almost a degree of kind of suffering, right, that you can intimate what ought to be, as it were. So it's a complicated picture that he lays out for us. But in his engagement with the tradition of kind of philosophical aesthetics that goes from Kant via Hegel and Schelling and so on and into the present, Adorno wants to invite us to consider the notion of natural beauty in a bid to reimagine a possible kind of reconciliation, as he would call it, between humankind and nature. And that this is ultimately the arena in which the kind of utopian, thrust of his thinking, I think, really comes to be most palpable, albeit as always in a way that is kind of, that is quite thoroughly negative. I don't know if I can put it any more clearly. It's a peculiar thing because it's where all of the registers of Adorno's thinking kind of overlap, right? There's an epistemological claim in there. There's a kind of ethical claim in there. And it all plays out in the sort of aesthetic arena. And to the extent that Adorno believes that all of the contradictions that, you know, unearths in various kind of philosophical texts, schools, approaches, and so on, to the extent that he believes that they all have a real material correlate in kind of, you know, in historical life, as it were, this modest lens of, you know, looking at kind of artworks actually bears a really significant kind of weight. There's a lot that's going on there. And in a way, you can kind of retro-engineer, where Adorno sort of like started in his philosophical concerns, starting with his inaugural lecture on the actuality of philosophy, with his critique of idealism. You can retro-engineer that from the standpoint of his aesthetics much, much later on. It's the final formulation, if you like, of Adorno's thinking. And because it's a fragment, it's also a beautifully suggestive and inviting one, the aesthetic theory, I mean. And since there are such prominent references to the image ban in there, in their relation to works of art, which are supposed to be these sort of, you know, imageless images of utopia, if you like, I think it's well worth looking there for kind of answers or for clues. This is, of course, also where the kind of, you know, charges of elitism and so on kind of come from, right? Because the works that Adorno cites are often quite demanding and presuppose quite a lot of viewers in a way that doesn't come easily, right? But I guess, well, anyway, that's where he chose to place his emphasis, right?
Thank you so much. I think that's just a wonderful sort of summary of the stakes that are going on in the book, but also sort of Adorno's thought as a whole, which is in a way sort of how I understood this book as I was reading it. Just wonderful, clear, crisp prose, which on a subject dealing with Kant, Hegel, and Adorno is not what you always find. I really enjoyed it. We're unfortunately running out of time here. Thank you so much for joining us. I just have one final question, and that is, what are you working on now?
Well, first of all, let me just say once more, thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity to chat with you about this book, which seems a long way away at this point. Like I say, you know, it started life as a PhD dissertation. I completed it in 2016, and I haven't done a great deal on Adorno since then. So some of these points I'm trying to remember, you know, as we speak. But anyway, I do hope that, you know, listeners will have taken something away from this.
Absolutely.
What am I working on now? I am working on a project on the concept of community as it emerges in the writings of Friedrich Hölderlin, the great late 18th, early 19th century German poet, you know, quasi kind of romantic outlier on some readings. And in particular, I'm interested in the way that this term is brought out by three of his early 20th century readers, and they are Walter Benjamin, Gustav Landauer, and Franz Rosenzweig. And I hope to turn this into a book eventually on figures of community in Hölderlin and his readers, these three readers in particular. And what I'm interested in is how communities with nature, certain kinds of political community, and certain kinds of community with divinity, if you like, are conceptualized by these authors in a manner that is, in each case, very pointedly not national, not nationally coded, which in the history of Hölderlin's reception obviously plays a kind of role. So whilst that, you know, may be a footnote in a sense to Hölderlin's reception and to Hölderlin more generally, I do hope that the wider resonance of that theme actually will prove to have, you know, some bearing on the present, not just in the, you know, specifically German context, but more generally.
That sounds so exciting. Thank you so much for joining us. Sebastian Czyskalaski, everyone. The book was Adorno and the Ban on Images. My name is Lucas Hoffman. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Lucas.